Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I am your host, Emma Gunn Wardner, and joining me on this episode, I'm very pleased to say that I have the author and journalist, Joe Hoare, who popped round to Shay Emma Gunn's, whatever you like to call it, the Emma Gunn studio, my office, to talk about her incredible career. She was style editor on Heat magazine for many years. She was style editor covering fashion and beauty while I was at OK Magazine covering fashion and beauty. So we would often cross paths at events and things like that. So we've known each other for a long, long time. But since leaving, she has written numerous books. I kid you not, she has penned 7 books. She'll tell you how and when and why. But I know that when I've talked to authors previously on this show, one of the questions that listeners have really enjoyed hearing the answer to is the creative process. How do you get motivated? How do you sit down and actually write a book? And considering Jo has been so disciplined and written 7, it's impressive, even more impressive and even more juicy that I want to pick apart her entire process, how she set about it, and all of the things that she has done and put in place to make sure that her books are sent to her publisher on deadline. In and around all of that, we also talk about the fact that we are both print dinosaurs. We both started our careers on print magazines made of paper. And now journalism is a very different thing. It's online, and we talk about diversifying, what she's been doing. Obviously, I have a podcast as well as writing for magazines and digital titles. But we talk about basically how to stay relevant. Like, if you just continue to work on magazines, it is tough out there and it might not pay the bills. So what do you do? If you don't know about Jo Hoare, she is just so gosh darn funny. And I asked her to describe her books, and she said, sort of paraphrasing here, but basically in all of her books, she takes a side swipe at popular culture. So if you go to her author page on Amazon, she's written things like What Your Dog's Breed Says About You, A Survival Guide to Festivals, Cope With Everything, Rain, Tents, Toilets, Torrential Rain, Too Much Booze and More, Don't Be a Nordic, which is a book that she has left in my flat, which I'm devouring, Why Embracing the Scandi Lifestyle Won't Change Your Life, So You Think You're a Millennial. It's just, and it's funny, and she manages to, it's one thing to make a quip, but she manages to make something that is a book, the entire thing she manages to make funny. So we talk about all of that in the feature, about how tempting it is to write about your personal life when you're a journalist, because the first person piece is king, and how to do that in a way that doesn't sell out everyone you know and love. And you'll be pleased to hear that she talks about She's got some amazing, absolutely amazing celebrity gossip anecdotes, which is making me chuckle because I'm now remembering them. They were fabulous. And so before the end of the show, just at the end, we sort of do a, we can't leave without you telling us some of those stories. And by Jiminy, does she. So I hope that you enjoy it. If you're following me on social media and you're listening to this show when it goes out, you'll know that I am nearly in the middle of my 40 Days of 40 festival, as I like to call it. It's celebrating something normal slash wonderful slash fantastical every day in the 40-day run up to my 40th birthday on December the 17th. And I've had a lovely weekend so far. I met up with Jules von Hepp. If you remember, he's been on this show. He has a podcast called Jules and Sarah. And he said, come round, lass. I'll take you for a walk. So I popped round yesterday afternoon, it was pouring with rain, and we went for an absolutely epic walk along the Thames, which was very muddy, and he had warned me to wear my all-weather boots, and they remained watertight, which I was pleased about. But it was just such a gorgeous, gorgeous day, catching up with somebody, and in the spirit of 40 Days of 40, it was just giving that person just 100% of your attention, and not being on your phone, or having to rush off somewhere, and it was just bliss. So thank you, Jules, if you're listening, I'm sure you are, for a really incredibly beautiful day. And I'm going to be doing a couple of mini episodes just to keep you updated on 40 Days of 40, because I'm getting ever such a lot of DMs, and I think a couple of short little episodes throughout the week might be a nice way of keeping you up to speed. Right, I think it probably goes without saying that I'm going to put all of Jo's links in the show notes on iTunes and emmaguns.com. I will be putting the links to all of her books, and if you want to get in touch with her or me, all you have to do is send an email to thebeautypodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM me on Twitter and Instagram, where I'm at Emma Guns. Often when I have authors on, people send me emails to ask them questions directly. I will happily pass those on. So here she is, and I really hope that you enjoyed this episode and had an absolute ball recording it. Thank you, Jo, for being such a fantastic dress. Thank you, Jo, for being such a fantastic guest. Here it is, The Emma Gunn Show, featuring author and journalist Jo Hall. Hi, Jo. Welcome to The Emma Gunn Show.
Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Everybody, Jo has trekked all the way over to my humble abode, which I'm always very grateful for. So
it was
for
a bit of a trek because I didn't look at my journey planner properly, and I got a bus somewhere entirely unnecessary. But
Did you?
Yes.
And she texted me saying, it's about a mile to your flat from the station, isn't it? And I was like, where are you? Stop where you are.
That's Google Maps' fault. You might have to look into that.
Yes, I will. I will lodge a complaint. Who do I write to? So Jo Hall, everyone, is somebody that I've known for a jolly long time, because for many years we were... sort of equivalents,
yeah,
weren't we?
Like sisters.
So I was fashion and beauty editor on OK Magazine at the same time as you were. What was your title?
Oh, style editor, but same thing.
Yeah,
beauty, yeah.
It's a different way of saying the exact same thing. Sounds a bit chicer as well, by the way.
Style editor.
Yeah, I was always jealous. So we would go to the same events, trips, yeah, etc. We've been to Rio together.
Which was amazing.
Which was absolutely fantastic. And the reason that I wanted to get Jo on the show is because, A, she's always... Well, she's a great storyteller, everybody. And I think everyone
no
should
pressure.
Have... No pressure at all. But if you don't perform, then you're going in my basement. I don't have a basement. I wish I did.
Oh, my God. No, I thought you meant as in... That's a podcasting term for people that don't quite make it. Have you had anyone that you haven't...
Everyone's made the cut. I wouldn't put anyone in the podcast basement. Although, never rule it out. You never know.
It could happen.
Jo is also sitting under my whiteboard, which has... people that I'm after, and there's a column of dream guests, and the second she walked in my office, she just tapped to the board, because listeners, I have Celine Dion on the dream guest list.
I mean, I'm over the moon at that.
So if you know Celine Dion, or if you are Celine Dion, please get in touch with the show and let's make this happen.
She would be brilliant.
She would be amazing.
I mean, I think someone needs to make this happen. We must know someone from our old show busy ways.
Well, let's talk about that, because how long have you been out of your showbiz job now for? for?
So I worked at Heat for 11 years, which makes me feel so old. And I left there about a year and a half ago, something like that.
Does it feel like another life?
In some ways it does, in some ways it doesn't. It is quite a relief to have a lot of my social life back. Mm. I'm sure you had the same, okay. And it is a bit, oh, my diamond shoes are too tight. But going to parties and events every night, once you get sort of past 30-something, mm-hmm. as we are, you're just so knackered.
Mm.
And I think your friends are starting to get fed up with you because, oh, can we do something? You think, oh, I could do something in three Thursdays. But, oh, no, I can't because I might have to go to this thing then. So not having that pressure to go to kind of three or four events a week was the first thing I noticed. I was like, wow, I can actually make plans. And
even just going to the doctor.
Yeah, exactly. Going to the doctor or being in to have your delivery, your sales yeah, deliver yeah. arrive. And I just kind of realised, thought, God, that really was a lot more of my life than I realised.
Completely. I don't know if you had this, but because we used to do weddings, obviously, at the magazine, so a lot of it was weekends. And I remember about 5 years in realising that I'd had to turn down every friend's wedding.
To go to...
to accommodate.
Someone from Steps' yeah. third blessing of their 14th marriage or something.
Even if it was just a recce, just to go and like do a dummy
just
run.
Take up so much time. I think I also realised that what takes up a lot of time is just keeping up with everything. I'd be in conference and they'd be talking about, especially the sort of in the latter few years of me working at Heat, when celebrity was changing so much and there would literally be a new celebrity and a new reality show every single week. And I'd be sitting in conference thinking, I don't know who, you know, Sue, she wouldn't be called Sue. I don't know who Charlotte, Johnson is. Like, shit, who is this person? And Googling it frantically and going, oh, she went out with someone that was in TOWIE and she's, like, been in the background of Made in Chelsea twice. And I just think, I don't have the space in my brain to keep this anymore. I don't know if when I was younger it was just different because I was genuinely interested, or I think what's more likely is celebrity was just very different then.
I think it's two things. Celebrity was very different, but also the second you make celebrity your job, it stops being as tantalising.
Busman's holiday, I suppose.
A little bit. It's like, you know, how many... Be honest, you probably have turned down invitations to things that when you said, oh, I was supposed to go to such and such tonight, but honestly, I just needed a night in to do my ironing.
And everyone thinks, oh, you spoilt cow.
Exactly. And you're like, but my ironing is 7 feet high.
Well, I actually don't have an iron, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. Every time I put on social media that I'm doing my ironing, people are like, you do what?
Yeah, what are you ironing?
Clothes.
What? But don't you just shake them? This is thrilling for people. Laundry tips.
Joe, I really want to get you onto the podcast to talk about my ironing.
Sorry.
What laundry detergent do you use?
I thought that was going to be a genuine question.
No, I am sort of interested. No, I'm... Well, maybe we'll take this offline.
Yeah, offline. Offline comfort chat.
Yeah. Oh, so it's comfort. Yeah. Okay, interesting. Okay, right. But you're also an author, and you say that you've been out of Heat for 18 months.
Yeah.
In that time, you have 6 books are out.
I wrote 3 when I was still at Heat. Not in Heat Hours. Yes, in Heat Hours. No, really. And I have written, 4 in the 18 months that I've left.
So that's really impressive, because I think a lot of people can identify, I'm certainly one of them, with the fact that I've thought about writing one book many, many times and I'm still bookless. So good on you.
Well, you say that. I mean, these are the kind of books I write. They're comedy books, really. The way I describe them is I sort of say they're those books that you buy for a present for someone in Urban Outfitters. That's the kind of thing. But there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not doing myself a disservice. Like, they are a good present. But they're sort of side swipes at popular culture. So I've written one on hipsters, one on people you work with in an office, which we'll talk about later when we talk about the mining your life. One on, God, I can't remember, I've written one on festivals and one on being anti-Nordic, which is the one that's out this week that I bought for you.
Thank you very much.
So it's not by any means kind of me churning out 90,000 word books. They do take a lot of time and effort.
You're not Agatha Christie, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, I'm not Agatha Christie yet.
Yeah, obviously. you know, we'll work up to that.
Yeah, we'll work up to it.
And I think, certainly when I started out in magazines, I sort of started out in the early 2000s, and I would see a lot of people who had been in magazines for a while getting book deals, because at the time there was a lot of money in it, and journalists would transition actually into author a lot more than they do now. So it seemed like something that was sort of an obvious...
Yeah, an obvious path. A sort of obvious path. Yeah, and I think also at that there was a lot more money in books now, and you know, I'm sure we both know some people who kind of got enormous, you know, six-figure book deals to sort of write. If I mean, some people don't like the term chick lit. I don't think there's anything wrong with it personally. I think it's really snobby to go, oh, I hate chick lit, I loathe chick lit. Or I think that's why they're trying to rebrand it as women's fiction. So lots of kind of ex-mag editors and writers went on to go and write women's fiction. And it was huge, I think, for about 5 years. Nearly every sort of new women's book that came out, so we'd be like, oh, so-and-so's got that, that's the one we know. And that has died off a bit, I think. I think that's not guaranteed now. You know, if you're a journalist, that definitely would have been an in 5, 6, 7 years ago with publishers. And I don't think it is as much now. I think they probably care more if you've got a huge social following.
100%. Mm. Well, you can see it. So it isn't an obvious transition. So how did you make it happen? You were writing the style section of Heat Weekly, and not putting words in your mouth, but listeners, I can vouch for the fact that it might seem like a lovely cushy job, and obviously there are lovely cushy things about it, but actually getting all those pages to print on time and making sure that your content is different, varied, and covers all of the things that it needs to cover from the magazine's perspective as well as the reader's perspective, it's a real juggling act, and it takes a lot of work. So it's a completely different thing writing this book.
Yeah, it was a completely different thing actually, and I am very undisciplined, and when I wrote my first one, so a publisher approached me, and they were looking for, in their words, a kind of funny person that could write about fashion and lifestyle trends. And they had, I think they'd seen something that I'd written in Heat. So I ended up doing a sample for them, and then they offered me a couple of books with them. A full-time job, and getting that first book done was hard. And I am never one of those people that says something like, well, if you just do an hour here, you get up an hour earlier, that it works. But I made myself do an extra hour in my working day. So I wrote a lot of it at my desk at Heat at the time. So we started at 9:30, so I'd either come in at 9:30, we finished at 6, or I'd stay till 7. And I just pretended that was my working day, and that's how I got that done, because I just wouldn't have been able to fit it in otherwise. I mean, there was the odd, like, Sunday where I had to kind of, like, sit at my desk for 12 hours panicking. But mostly I did it an hour at a time, plodding along.
So I've had this conversation with people on the podcast before, is about what kind of pressure do you respond to? And I do call it pressure. I'm the sort of person where if you give me 3 weeks to write a feature, I will think about it on that first day and get really excited, and then I won't actually do it until that deadline.
For 12 more days.
Yeah. Exactly, breathing down my neck. Are you able to be a bit better, or is that you?
No, I'm terrible. I'm an awful, awful, awful last minute person, and I'm getting worse. And I don't know what to do about it.
So it's paying off. Like, you've hit all your deadlines and you've got books out, so it's not really, it's not serving you poorly.
My book editor might not agree with you if he's listening to this, because I keep handing things in a bit late. Yeah, I'm awful, and I always have been. I remember at university, the morning of having to hand things in, because I went to university a million years ago, and you still had to go and hand it in on paper.
Yeah.
I can remember sort of typing with one hand and blow drying my hair with the other, because I was so, and also it was obviously still really important to me to have blow dried hair. I don't know why. Well, not now with my filthy hair. And yeah, I'm still like that now. You know, if someone says, oh, deadline's Friday, I think, well, that's end of day Friday, which is Monday.
Yeah.
Always push it.
Which, that's end of day Friday, until at 6 o'clock you're saying, oh, my Wi-Fi's out.
Sorry.
I'll send it from my retreat that I'm going on this weekend.
I just won't be able to look at it.
Yeah.
I am terrible with deadlines. I would really like to be better, and I'm obsessed with reading sort of how other people do it, and I think I'll definitely do that. And I know people have all these like apps on their laptops and stuff which block out the internet, or there's this really popular one with writers called Scrivener. And I just,
it's not cheap, there was about 50 quid.
I think I'm not doing that. Another friend of mine has got one where he types, and if you haven't reached a certain limit by 15 minutes, it deletes everything you've done. I mean, I said, but I would just go XXXXX, and he said
I would just cut and paste a certain amount of words.
That wouldn't work for me, but he said he's a novelist, and he said that's what works for him.
Yeah, if that works, so everyone's a different personality type, but I always look for a way to cheat the system.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds mad to me. Like, what if you, like, really needed to go to the loo, or the doorbell rang, or...
Well, also, we just have to talk about that. There have been two deliveries since Joe's arrived at my house. And I made, and each one, like, made a hash of my name, obviously. Even the guy who delivered the parcel addressed to Emma Guns, which was spelled with two N's. And I went, oh, now do you see why I hate my name? And Joe just looked at me and went, really?
Well, I quite like having a comedy name. When I used to work at Heat, one of my favourite things was when people would ring up and they would be too embarrassed to say whore, and I would never help them. So they'd be on the phone, they'd say, can I speak to Joe? Johuare. I could totally have stepped in and gone, oh yeah, it is whore, and I'd just be going, who? And I know it's mean, but or some people would say Joe Hare or Joe Ohoare. I think, what, where you get that? Whore's not that uncommon a name.
No, but I just, yeah, I can understand why. Did you get crap for it at school?
Well, I actually didn't, and it was thanks to two girls who I really do wish them every success now, because they got a lot of crap. There was one girl called Sarah Bottoms and one girl called Louisa Butt, and when you are 9, 10 and 11, bottom and butt is a lot funnier than whore, especially in our kind of, you know, pre-Pornhub days where not everyone knew what a whore was. Nowadays the kids probably like know it from about 5. So everyone was like, oh, ha ha ha, big butt, fat bottoms kind of thing, rather than you whore. So I pretty much got away with it. So thanks to those two ladies for protecting me.
Yeah, there were no comedy names in my school, but there was just the unpronounceable Sri Lankan name that everyone made an absolute
I don't think I still even know how to say your name.
That's why, just call me Emma Guns.
Emma Guns, yeah. Emma G.
Yeah, although, it's because that's just become my sort of nickname, Emma G or Emma Guns, and so I just think it's just easier than spelling out my surname. Back to books. Right. You did a course, so let's dig into that situation.
So after writing these kind of comedy books, which wasn't entirely dissimilar from my style at Heat. Heat was always like a bit kind of tongue in cheek, sort of piss takey, but not in a mean way. So that style lent itself quite easily to the comedy books. When I left Heat, I thought, I just want to see if I can do something else. Like, I am, I'm confident, I'm a pretty good writer some of the time, but can I write something other than jokes and, things about fashion and beauty? And I really wanted to write a fiction book, and I'd had this idea knocking around in my head for a little while, which is actually based on a beauty trip. Us talking about that Rio trip earlier, it was another trip with the same company, and we went to Mustique, which is
I didn't go on that
which,
one
which was
heard
pretty,
about it
pretty spesh. And if you don't know what Mustique is, I'm really surprised by how many people don't know what Mustique is, but I suppose
it's a perfume, isn't it?
It's a perfume. I suppose not everyone maybe had to be so obsessed with the Middletons as we were.
Oh, is that where they holiday?
Yeah, I think they have a villa there or something. And so Mustique's private island in the Caribbean, which Bryan Adams has a private beach there, and Mick Jagger had a house there. Princess Margaret used to go there all the time and do all manner of things, apparently. And I went there and I just thought, God, this place is so weird. I thought, A, I think everyone's definitely swingers. And B, the staff were just, they sort of had this like almost extra sensory sense that you would talk about something you wanted. I remember one night we'd all been out and we came home, we were a bit drunk, very drunk, everyone jumped in the pool, it was a white party in all their white clothes. And someone said, oh God, when I'm drunk at home I always have Marmite toast. And we turned around and there was a plate of Marmite toast. Like, I don't think we'd even seen anyone bring it up. And we're like, is we dreaming? This is really weird. Or you would go in the shower and your clothes that you'd left in your bedroom, by the time you'd come out the shower and you'd done your hair and whatever, your clothes would be ironed, cleaned, folded, and put back on your bed. They say no one leaves Mustique with dirty clothes. And the whole... I just thought, God, the staff would do anything for you here. Like, I could probably murder someone and they'd help me. And then that was my idea for a book.
That was what percolated on the plane home.
And I kind of thought...
Oh. Under your eye mask.
Yeah, under my eye mask. Don't talk to me, I've got my eye mask.
Joe likes to sleep on flights. If you ever sit next to
a plane. On a flight. Yeah, it's so lovely. I love flights. Where else can you just press a button and anyone brings you anything you want?
Oh. Well, when you're in a certain cabin.
Well, no, I think you can get a drink in economy.
Between the hours of take up, well, yeah. Anyway, we digress. So you had the fiction idea. How did you set about?
So I, as we said, I know that, as we've said, I'm hugely undisciplined, and I have been worse since I'm freelance. So I thought I need what is going to give me a bit of a kick up the arse. And I did a bit of research into kind of looking at going back to uni, because I did an English literature master's and I did think about doing a PhD, and then I sort of got to starting to think about it and thought, oh my God, this would be boring as hell and no one will ever read it. So I gave up on that idea. But I did some research and I found this thing called the Faber Academy, and I'm quite sceptical about sort of courses quite often. I remember whenever we used to look for interns at Heat, we would have these people come in and I would just think they're being absolutely ripped off, because they'd be doing these things that sort of the, you know, the University of Fashion and Marketing or something, and they'd be doing these mad courses that were costing them about 20 grand a year.
Yikes.
And they were just bullshit. They were just made up. Mm. It would literally be like, oh, but I've done fashion journalism with a beauty side module. And I think, God, you would have been better off, like, doing an internship for 6 months.
Going and working at a newspaper for a week.
And I would feel so sorry for people who were sort of, like, pouring their dreams and a considerable amount of money into doing these, like, nonsense courses. That I was really didn't want to fall prey to that myself. But found this thing called the Faber Academy, met a few journalists that had done it, and it's had all these, like, huge success stories, like, you know, S.J. Watson that wrote Before I Go to Sleep, he did it. Chloe Esposito, who wrote Mad, which was everywhere this summer, did it. Emma Flint, who does Little Deaths. I think they've had something like 70 books published in 10 years or something.
Oh, okay, that's impressive.
So I decided to apply for that, and I actually thought, oh, I applied on the deadline. I thought, I'm not going to get onto it. Like, it's really, really competitive and stuff. And I was very lucky I did get onto it, and I think, for me, it was a bit like going to Weight Watchers or something like that. That
accountability.
You have to go every week, and if you haven't done anything, you're they wouldn't shame you, but you would be ashamed, sloping in. You know, everyone else has written 20,000 words and you've written 4, which did happen.
And two of those your name.
Yeah. No, 3, Joanne Elizabeth. And yeah, that's kind of kick-started me thinking in a different way, and definitely taught me some things that maybe I thought I knew, some things that I definitely didn't know, and sort of turned my brain around in a way that is, you know, you don't have to look for the joke every time. You know, my writing previously has been very comedic, and that was the hardest thing for me. Like, not every paragraph has to have 3 jokes in them, so that's very difficult.
Well, your Facebook statuses are a thing of legend. I would remember going to the same sort of event as you. Well, not the same sort of event, the same event as you, and having thoughts and feelings on the way home, and then turning on Facebook, and you would have articulated them.
Maybe I need to be a bit more careful about
that. And I did think sometimes, oh, I wouldn't have the balls to write that, but yeah, so that's quite a lot of retraining your kind of... Especially when you've been on a title for a really long time. I remember when I first started freelancing, people sort of saying, we need to beat the okay out of you, we need to beat this style of writing out of you. And I look back now and think, actually, you don't, because that's a skill in it. It's not a bad skill.
No, it is, and there's a market for it. I mean, when I first went freelance, I thought, oh God, you know what? My stuff is too silly, it's not highbrow enough. But sure, people like silly.
Mm.
And silly doesn't mean it's not intelligent or well-written or captivating. It's just, you know, I'm probably never going to write for, I don't know, The Lancet, but people like to be entertained, so we shouldn't feel we have to have that beaten out of us, I don't think. But I know what you mean, because I think it often, or sometimes if someone slightly more highbrow has asked me to write for them, I do sort of curb it a bit and think, oh God, that is the thing. And I think, well, they wouldn't have asked me if they didn't want a bit of silly.
Do you do this? Because I definitely do this. If somebody asks me to write for them and it's either an editor or a magazine that I perceive as being sort of, you know,
swanky,
smart, I end up writing in my phone voice.
Yes! No, I know what you mean, yeah.
And then I sort of read it back to myself. Well, that sounds jolly good. Well done.
Yeah, jolly good.
And I use a vocabulary that I wouldn't normally use because I think, no, I need to
upgrade myself.
Yeah, totally.
And I think that's really, really easy to do. And I definitely do that. But then I look at it now and I try and go back and think, come on, put a bit more of yourself in that, because they wouldn't have asked you if they didn't want some of it. And I think it's when I try to do it, it sounds a bit fake.
Also, when I sometimes we learn a lot of writers, so my social media will often be full of people on a Sunday saying, oh, so-and-so's piece in such and such a decent newspaper is the best thing I've ever read. And I think, oh, I'll go out and buy it then. And I read it and I think, oh, this is a bit like Shakespeare. I'm going to need some help with this. I have to read it a couple of times. I'm a bit of a basic bitch.
It's really easy to feel intimidated by things like that as well. And you think, well, people put important, must read. And you're like, oh, God, I read it and like didn't really get anything out of it.
Yes.
Because I didn't know what that meant and I didn't know what this meant. It's just horses for courses, isn't it?
It is horses for courses. So do you feel now that you've found your voice, do you feel like doing the course, writing these books, do you feel like in writing the fiction book, which I know is still a work in progress, do you feel that you've hit a groove that feels more Jo and Elizabeth Hall?
Fancy. Yes, definitely. I think I didn't... In the heat heyday, I felt that I was absolutely true to my voice, and I was very lucky that I was working somewhere that was exactly how I wanted to write. It matched my kind of tone and humour and stuff. So
that's part of the success of Heat, I think, because I mean, in Heat's heyday, you could not touch it.
No, and the thing I always remember about, we used to have this big picture up on the door, and it was this big quote from Christian Guru Murphy, it was about Heat, and he had been asked what media he read. Well, yeah, it was read back then, because this was kind of like pre-smartphone and stuff, and he had said like, oh, you know, I read The Economist, blah, 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 and he said, and I read Heat every week, and he said, and the reason I like Heat, he said, because a DVD review on page 95 is as funny as a celebrity interview on page 5, whatever, and he said every single word, I'm paraphrasing, Christian, if you're listening, but it was something like that, and I thought that was, I felt really proud to work somewhere where everything was funny and had tone, and
And as a competitor, as somebody who was on a competitive title, should we say, I definitely used to read it and think, I really envy the fact that there's that. It felt like freedom. Whereas obviously I would write about...
Yeah, we were hardly curtailed at all. I mean, maybe we should have probably been a bit more. We did have a lot of freedom. You know, if you had an opinion and you wanted to write something, as long as you weren't, you know, going to cost them £100,000 in lawyer's fees... put it in, which couldn't and probably wouldn't happen now, but it was a very, very cool place to work at the time to be able to do that. It's very like freeing to sort of find your voice, something like that, so I'll always be very grateful to Heat.
Can we talk about one of the characters in your fiction novel?
Yes, we can.
Because she's a very popular guest on this podcast. Well, she's not in it. Has one of your characters been inspired?
Yes, and she knows about it. So
she's so proud.
So Lady Bagshot. Well, I haven't decided if she's going to be a lady yet or not, because there's another royal person. I don't want it to look too like royal-tastic. So she might just have to be a commoner. I haven't broken this to her yet.
Crikey.
Is loose, well, no, tightly based on the lovely Nadine Baggins.
So if you had to describe Mrs. Bagshot.
I think she's definitely a muse. Well, she is, for want of a better term, a sort of very high level madam, I suppose. She runs a business which organises seasonal pop-up sex parties at very high-end international places. So and one of these is Mustique. She pops over to Mustique for a month a year, organises a month of jollies and buggers off back home, and then, you know, maybe she goes to some other exotic locations.
I've got some wonderful suggestions for catchphrases for Ms. Bagshot.
Oh, please.
Which I will share with you. Because I was telling this to Caroline Hirons last night on the phone. The thing that Nadine texts me the most is main grid bitch.
Main grid. read pitch.
If I send her a picture of something and she likes it, instead of saying, what's a really nice picture, she put it on your main grid. She just goes, main grid, bitch.
Don't be wasting that on stories.
Yeah. No, I did exactly that happened yesterday. I had a blow dry and I did a boomerang on strawberries. Did a boomerang on stories and she just literally within 5 seconds, main grid, bitch.
I'm awful with stories. I tend to only do them when I'm away somewhere and then I'm worried that I look like a smug bitch and then that and then but then my day-to-day life is far too boring. No one wants to see my like dirty kitchen table, so
but you did put that up. No,
yeah,
that
was... I did actually. Yeah, it's like, come on, let's put that up. But yeah, I'm not very good with stories. I need to get better at it.
Well, it's just
a lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot maybe your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's all such false reality.
Oh, yeah. Some of this has been created for your entertainment.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great disclaimer. Yeah. That's a great Instagram profile, isn't it? Like the beginning of Tamoy.
Some of this has been created for your entertainment.
Yeah. The tans are real.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Are you into Real Housewives?
I'm not. No, but you know what I did get into recently? The British one with Cheshire. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Did you see the last episode?
The reunion.
But Paul Brand Dowling, he was like a referee. I was like, who are these women?
I'm sorry, but I was quite cross with Brian Dowling.
For not getting more into it.
Let them have a scrap. Don't keep throwing to a montage.
It's like Jeremy Kyle. It's like...
Oh, you need to watch the Atlanta one and then you'll see a real reunion.
I don't know. I don't feel a connection sometimes with American reality TV stars.
I do know what you mean. I think as well, the listeners will probably agree, it might derail your productivity in writing the fiction book, which we obviously all want to come out in 2018.
Hurry up, you lazy cow.
How far, can you say how much of the way you are through it?
I am less than half, but I had another of my comedy books, which I handed in last week, which I kept blaming that, going, oh, I need to write my last comedy book.
When you say less than half, how many words should a book be? Is there a, like, do they say, roughly?
Well, yeah, I think, like, 80,000 to 120 is about average, unless you're writing a novella, which people don't really do because no one really wants to buy them because it's full price for a half of a book, let's be honest. No, people do write fantastic novellas, I'm sure. Heart of Darkness novella. Yes, yeah, so I am kind of less than half. And I keep saying this is going to be my writing month. This is going to be the month where I do no paid work. And then the roof needs fixing or something. I think, oh, I better do a bit of paid work.
Yeah. So. It's a tricky balance to put out. I would say this podcast sits in that territory. And there have been weeks where I've been like, I've got to get a podcast out, but I've got to get paid.
Yeah, it's really, really difficult when you're trying to do something new that you kind of think, well, if X, Y, and Z happens, I will be making money from this. So I should be investing in, it's kind of investing in your future almost, isn't it? But then you think, but also I need to go somewhere that's going to, you know, I need that hitting my account next week, not in 2 years.
So it's balancing the... keeping the money coming in, but also the speculate to accumulate situation.
And that was quite a sort of mind shift for me as well, because I have found myself, since trying to write this book, taking on some things that I maybe would have done, things that weren't as well paid, but were far more fun. So I was offered a contract recently that would have been super fun. The money wasn't very good. And then at the same time, I was offered something else, which was... not as much fun, but and I thought I've just got to do it. And previously, I wouldn't have. Not saying, oh, I can afford to throw money away, but I would have thought that sacrifice was one I'd be happy to make. But now you've got to balance it. You know, the money needs to come in if you want to be doing these kind of, you know, creative, freeing yourself up things that are setting you up for the future.
How do you, because I think it all comes down to diversifying. Mm. When we were in our heyday, and I think we definitely enjoyed a beautiful time in journalism.
Oh, God, yeah, which I think we were like, I mean, I think we slightly missed that kind of mad 90s hedonism.
Of we missed, yeah.
Hearing those stories about, you know, bags of cocaine being delivered to offices and whatnot.
I never heard those stories.
But the, yeah, absolutely the heyday for, you know, I mean, I think at one point he was selling like 800,000 copies a week, and you could kind of be putting, you know, we put anything on the pages, and it was such a fun place to be. So to go from that heyday, it's very difficult.
And I feel like there are those of us who have been like, right, okay, so the situation's changed, so we can either try to stay relevant in print and essentially write a lot more for the same amount of money.
Yeah.
Or you can try other avenues. You've got your books. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's other things that you do. But do you think that having those other channels is now just completely essential?
I think you have to. And everyone I speak to, you know, whenever I go to journalist events, everyone is. I mean, it's a negative thing to call it Plan B, but everyone is talking about what's their other route. You know, do they want to work more with brands? Would they like to launch a brand themselves? Do they want to write? You know, I have so many journalists, like even some I don't know very well, message me on Facebook or something asking about books, and people are definitely looking for. You just need another strand, I think. Really, I think it's very difficult to make money purely from journalism right now. To make decent money.
Unless you're a superstar columnist.
Or, yes.
As we were talking before we
it's
started
It's a small
recording.
Percentage yeah. of people, I and, think.
That, unless you have a speciality as well.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there are people that are fantastic writers and do, you know, deservedly make loads of money. Mm. But the majority of, you know, 90% of people, I think, are sort of looking for another strand to their bow.
I think it's just absolutely crucial. You have to. But I think also, and I've had this conversation with guests before, and I know listeners have talked about it, is having that confidence. Because if you're in your groove, as it were, it can feel like books are something that other people write,
yeah.
or podcasting is something that other people do. So do you have any advice for kind of having the confidence to push forward?
I think sometimes it just takes one person or, you know, one publication or one strata of industry or something to believe in you, because I had that when I left Heat. I kind of thought, what have I done? That's all I've really known. You know, Heat was my first journalist job. And Glamour commissioned me for something, kind of, I got in touch out of nowhere. And I remember having this real sort of like, thank God, like if they want me, I hope other people will want me.
Yeah, all is not lost.
Yeah, and yeah. I kind of thought, oh, actually, do you know what, I would, and I probably wouldn't have had the confidence to approach a magazine like Glamour. I would have thought, oh, I'm Weeklies, oh, I'm Celebrity, oh, I'm, you know, a little bit lowbrow. So for that was a real, and after then I thought, well, no, maybe I can do this.
Did you have that when you were here? Did you feel any snobbery?
I actually never felt it from the industry, but I know other people have said they have. Maybe I'm just a bit of a blunderbuss that doesn't really notice and sort of thinks, oh, well, I just charge up to people and talk to them. But from people outside the industry, I always remember going to a party and someone introduced me to a friend, and this woman said to me, what do you do? I work at Heat. And she goes, oh, God, I hate Heat. It's disgusting. And I said, well, what do you do? And she said, oh, I can't remember what it was, something boring for British Gas. Yeah. And I said, I don't really like your tariffs, but I'm not banging on about it. Like, because it's the same, isn't it? And it's really difficult when you do something that's in the public, like, domain, that people can read what you write, we can make out, it's really easy to get all your trash. And I think, well, how rude, you know. I wouldn't go up to you and say, oh God, oh, you work for this shop, yeah, shit jumpers, you know.
I don't really like your tariffs.
Yeah, that's what I said. And she was like, you're weird. But yeah, that kind of thing. Or I sort of had people going, oh, don't you think, you know, why do you work at Heat when you, you know, when you went to uni? And I'd be like, nearly everyone in the office went to university. Like, people are really smart. Like, just because they're not writing about, you know, astrophysics doesn't mean we're not smart.
I know. It's a weird one, isn't it?
But I do still get that snobbery a lot as well. In fact, when I started this Faber course, a lot of people on the course were writing very serious books, and a few of them were a little bit sort of snobby with me. And then I think something, I don't know, one of them was quite rude to me, and I'd sort of turn around and I said, well, I've got a master's in 20th century literature, like, I could write that book, but I want to write this book. And she was like, oh, okay. Quite surprised. But that's confidence as well, isn't it? And I probably wouldn't have done that 2 years ago. I would have just sort of thought, oh yeah, well, you know, heat is my box and I should get back in it.
You're good at that, though. You're good at in the moment, because we've had a couple of conversations offline, listeners, and you've been saying things to me and I have been noting, God, you've got balls, in the loveliest way, because the situation you described, sort of speaking up for yourself in a moment where maybe someone was trying to get the upper hand or trying to get the better of you, you do sort of stick firm.
I mean, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Like, sometimes, like, a really small thing could really, like, knock me and I would just stay quiet. But then when it's really, I do pick my battles. When it's really important, I think, hang on a minute, no, I'm not having this.
Yeah.
Or I think if I know I can win, if I already think, well, I've already worked out that, like, that route over there is probably going to happen, so I'm going to stand up for this.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just lose my temper. So that's the problem as well. Like,
yeah, I think it's good to have a temper. I
think it's a useful thing to have, to be able to call on a temper.
I've always suppressed mine, suffocated it, and then just gone into a quiet strop where I just don't speak to anyone and have a cob on. And now I'm learning that I need to tap into my temper because it could be more...
I think it's good for you. And I much prefer to have... You know, my temper is gone and then I've forgotten about it 10 minutes later.
Yeah, but if you hang on to it and you're like, well, shit, yeah. I wish I'd said
that.
And
then it starts affecting you and you think, well, no, it's them that's a dick, not me. So, like, get it out.
You should write a piece for a magazine on confidence.
Well, no, but then sometimes I really, really struggle with it. Like, I hate public speaking. There's loads of things I hate doing, like walking into a room full of people I don't know. I really wouldn't enjoy that.
But I think this comes down to lots of conversations I've had recently. It's not linear. Like, you can be confident in one situation, doesn't mean you're going to be confident in another.
No, definitely. And I think people sometimes are quite surprised that there are some things that I wouldn't be confident about, because I am reasonably confident day to day. Or don't mind giving someone a bollocking or whatever.
But speaking about writing, we've talked about mining your life for features, because one of the changes in journalism has been first-person pieces.
Well, this confessional is, it's everything, isn't it? And it's what people want.
And actually, I was talking to a very established journalist yesterday at an event, and we were talking about how journalism has changed and how it used to be about being objective and offering the facts from all the relevant angles and almost leaving the reader to make a decision.
That, yeah.
And how now it's I, and there's this element of blog tone coming into really established big magazines. So I wondered if, when you are a jobbing journalist and you're thinking, I really need to make rent, how tempting it is to start mining your life and how you feel about
that. I have done a little bit of that, and actually it hasn't really been for financial. Some of the very personal pieces I've written, and it is such a cliche to say, but it is cathartic, and I have felt so much better afterwards. So I did a thing recently about a broken engagement, and I really thought about whether or not to do it, and I kind of thought, I don't really... There were some things in there that I hadn't maybe even sort of told my family about how I felt afterwards. And I thought, and I really ummed and ahed about it, but the commissioning editor is a really good friend of mine. I had full copy approval. I knew that they'd let me write it exactly how I was. And I felt really fantastic afterwards. And what's really nice as well is I had quite a few people that were either had broken engagements or maybe were going through divorces or big splits got in touch with me. And that, it sounds cheesy, like, thank you for writing that. Like, it made me feel better.
Yeah.
And so I was very pleased I did that. I have been asked to do some other things which I have said no to, which I feel are too personal, or if they're more about other people, you know, you don't really have the right to necessarily write about other people. And
I have
fallen foul of that once. I wrote what I thought was quite a funny piece on how I'm a terrible wedding guest, because I am just a terrible wedding guest.
Is that because you're a terrible drunk?
Yes, mainly it is a terrible drunk.
By the way, I say
drunk.
This is the woman who at the last wedding I went to was took myself off under a table to have a snooze, and my parting words before I disappeared under the tablecloth were, someone bring me some cheese in 15 minutes.
Well, I mean, I think that's very considerate. I wish I was that considerate. My worst one is, I was at this wedding and... I was bored as hell. Like, I'd gone there with an ex-boyfriend. We didn't really like each other anymore. I don't know why we'd gone to this wedding together. It's a really posh wedding, you know, the sort of one where you don't even really know the groom's name because he's called something like Pooface. And, it was like rowing themed. And, it was just a nightmare from start to finish. And they'd done this thing that they obviously thought was quite cute of not sitting you with anyone you know.
Oh, that.
I was sitting there. Everyone was awful. And I drank two bottles of white wine. And I had a row with someone on the table. And I was just sitting there just, and I couldn't eat anything because I was too pissed. And then the band went off for a break, and I could hear the music still carrying on in the background, and I thought, this feels like an invitation to me. So I crawled up. I didn't use the stairs. I crawled up. It was also a super posh wedding, so I had a full length navy ball gown on.
Excellent.
A bit like sort of a seal getting out of a swimming pool. I got up on the stage and they were playing just a music only version of Aha, Take On Me. So I decided to get up and do the vocals. And I got all the way through because everyone was just standing there looking aghast. And I started to sober up about a minute into it. But in my mind, I kind of thought, it's going to be more embarrassing to stop. I'm just going to carry on. So I just carried on doing it. And then at the end, I told everyone that I fancied the bride's dad because I thought he looked like Nigel Havers, which, I mean, I don't fancy Nigel Havers anyway. So,
no, he's an attractive man. Let's not put Nigel Havers down, Joe.
Okay.
I'll Google it afterwards.
I'd written another one about how I'd gone to a family wedding.
Wait, I'm sorry, I just have to ask you a question about the Aha solo. There's quite a lengthy instrumental bit in the middle.
Yeah, I've just stood there, gripping onto the microphone, like so, so tightly, and just looking at everyone, and I could see my ex-boyfriend going, get off, and I was just like this, nuh-uh-uh.
Did you think that was a request for a Prince song?
Oh God, imagine if it's like that. I might have done some moves.
You and I should go to a wedding. I've decided never to go to a wedding again. Oh. As a single girl, because the last wedding I went to, despite the fact that I RSVP'd, when I arrived I wasn't on the table plan.
That's why you had to get under it.
No, this was a different wedding.
Okay.
Sorry, that was the last wedding I went to. When I discreetly flagged it up to the brother of the bride, I was like, I appear not to be on the floor plan.
I don't have any dinner.
The way that the situation was dealt with was by the bride loudly addressing me in the middle of the room, in front of everybody, pre-lunch, saying, I've left you voicemails, I've sent you messages, I didn't get your RSVP. Well, you haven't messaged me, so this is embarrassing.
Yes.
For you, but actually more for me in this moment.
I'm going to have to sort of stand at the corner
like
work here.
Absolute twat, I stayed.
Oh, did you get a dinner?
Yeah, I ate the food and then I effed off.
Phew, yeah.
But I was just like, we've never spoken since.
I'm not surprised.
Not even a thank you for coming. Thank you for driving for 3 hours.
Rude.
Yeah.
Rude. Yeah.
But I think that now, if I ever get invited to a wedding again, I think we should go together.
Oh my God.
Because I did that at our, you know, Evie Leatham.
Mm.
At Evie Leatham's wedding, I kept eyeing up the stage, just thinking, God,
it's
go for a break.
It's so tempting, isn't it?
So tempting.
It's very tempting.
You have to come to 40 Days of 40 Karaoke when we do it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I won't do Aha.
No, well...
I do quite like a Celine for karaoke. My ultimate favourite is, if I have a partner to sing with me, is I Know Him So Well from Chess.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Barbara and Elaine.
So you can sing?
No. Barbara and Elaine. Me and my friend Martin absolutely loved that. He has to be Barbara because he's Scottish. and I'm always Elaine and I love it.
Okay, well, we're definitely doing karaoke together soon. Keep your eyes peeled to Insta stories, fans. Yes, let's go back. You said that you were going to write some other things about your personal life.
Yes, so I
might sneeze discreetly away from the microphone.
So some of those, I think you do have to say no to. Yeah, so sorry, on to the wedding one. I made a very small remark about being at a family wedding and the groom kind of making a bit of a naff speech, and like, I think I was on some really strong antibiotics and I was drunk and I like fell off my chair because I was laughing. And I thought that he wouldn't pick up on that, and he actually messaged me, and he wasn't pissed off or anything, but I thought, oh God, like, you forget, Pete. Sometimes I think you write something and you're like, it's gone, it's out there. And you forget that actually people are going to read that. And although that was a very small throwaway thing to me, I did realise afterwards, I was like, oh God, that's probably the best day of your life. And I've just taken the piss out of it in a national magazine. But he was cool with it. But I think there are some more personal things that I don't know. I think it depends where you are in your life at that time.
I agree with you. I think if it involves anyone else and you will expose a part of their life and you haven't asked for permission or anything like that, then I think one has to be quite guarded. But if you can tell a story from your perspective that might be useful to a reader, because that's the point, isn't it? To be useful, to put out content.
And getting it off your chest and writing it down does often make you feel better, I think. It is cathartic. As naff and cliche a word as cathartic is, it definitely did. Some of the pieces that I've written about sort of relationships and things like that have definitely made me feel better afterwards. And exactly the same as you, like, I read it and I think, oh, she's a similar age to me. She's a similar woman to me. She's had similar things. Oh, I don't feel so crap about the fact that, you know, X, Y, and Z.
And I guess as well, you were talking about the one about the broken engagement, and we'll put the link to that. Who was that for?
Grazia.
Oh, yes, of course. Do you know if it's online?
Yes.
Okay, listeners, I'm going to be putting the link to that in the show notes so that you can just click on that and read it. Show notes are on emmaguns.com and iTunes, of course. Did you ever think beyond the published? Did you ever think about the feedback?
I didn't really. But what was really nice is that actually they sent on to me some letters that some readers had written in. They said they did have quite a lot of letters from people sort of saying, God, people never talk about it. It's you know, we talk about divorce and things like that. But something like, for example, a broken engagement isn't really talked about.
And I remember seeing you and doing that awful thing of seeing you going, and you being like, no.
Yeah.
I felt really bad for you because I thought that's not the first time that it's happened and it's not going to be the last time, in the sense of being someone who saw you a lot.
You're explaining yourself, yeah.
I knew that it was coming up. Mm. So when I saw you, I thought, oh, have you got married yet? And it's like, oh, no, shit. Yeah. Whoops. So that must have been, as you say, working through it with the piece. Did that kind of...
I mean, the piece I wrote... most recently is a long time after, so it's it was actually about selling your engagement ring, and so this is years down the line, and it really did feel like a sort of closed chapter catharsis. And I did write a piece nearer to it, which I did do anonymously because I didn't have the confidence at the time to sort of put myself out there. I was a lot younger, but I felt better for writing it, just getting it down. But then, as you say, maybe it is quite nice just to write something, then people know. Maybe you don't really want to put these negative things as your Facebook status or something like that, do you? But you also don't want to have to explain to every single person that you see. And I had a lot of people say that to me, people that have had sort of different other things happen, you know, something that hasn't quite gone right, you know, whether it was in a relationship or trying for a baby or something like that. And people are well-meaning. People want to come up to you and go, oh, how fantastic. And you're like, no, you know, or you think you've got a job and you haven't got it, or, you know, so it's a really, I can see why people want to write these pieces. It's like sending out a newsletter, isn't it? Like one of those naff ones at Christmas. This is what we've done this year. Just on a sort of national scale.
Yeah, I find it very difficult, the boundaries thing. There are definitely things that I want to write about, but then I guess I do it on this podcast, so...
Yeah, and I think it's probably... And you have full control on this podcast, so, you know, if you listen to it back and think, oh, God, that person's going to know I'm talking about them, and that's going to affect my family, or...
Because I remember when I first went freelance, writing a piece for a magazine about having hirsutism... hirsute pursuits, being, you know, having facial hair, having body hair. And I wrote it. And when you're young and you hit puberty and you've got a moustache and a bit of a beard and some sideburns as a woman, it's not the norm. So you do feel all of these things. But they definitely, after the fact, there was definitely this push to try and see if there had been a barrier between my body hair and my sexual experiences.
Yeah.
And I really didn't want to go there. Mm. But it was a bit like, oh, you know, in order for the... And
people want, you know, people, we were in that business for a very long time. People, even at more high brackets, they want a salacious headline, don't they? Like, I remember when I wrote a thing about the broken engagement, this was for another magazine and I did it a long time ago. They wanted a headline, I burnt my wedding dress. And I actually pulled the piece. I said, I'm not writing this for you because I didn't, and we're not having that. Oh, but can we have something dramatic like that? And I was like,
but I'm selling, like, it's dramatic enough.
Yeah, this is not. So people always, I think people will often want to push, you know,
I didn't have sex until I was 51 because my bikini line was out of control, you know.
Because I'd never thought about waxing.
Yeah, exactly. So I think people kind of want to... That can be another problem with this kind of confessional, that people want it to be quite salacious.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you had full control over it, because you say it was very useful. Mm. It would be wrong of me to have you on the podcast and not get you to share some sort of salacious anecdote about your time at Heat that you can share.
Oh, yeah. Well, I kind of think... I don't really care now. A big one thing I didn't like about Heat, and this sounds absolutely ridiculous because it was celebrity magazines, I just never liked celebrities.
Preach hallelujah.
Yeah, and I was like, I just couldn't be doing with it. And I remember going to interview this girl band once, and one of the girls was so incredibly rude to me that I'm just going to sound like all I do is like cause a tantrum, and I would never normally do this. And I did actually say to the PR, I think we're just going to have to stop this because we were not going to be able to print any of this.
Yeah.
And it was a really cute feature. I think it was about holidays, and it was like, who's your favourite person to go on holiday with? And when I said that, she said to me, use your fucking imagination. And so it's like, okay. And I literally just said, well, that's cool.
Oh, like, my God.
Maybe we can't do this because I can't print that. And everything, where'd you like to go? Don't know. And I was like, oh, my God. And then she said to me, can you get me some food? I said, well, I don't know because I don't work here. Like, yeah, she was pretty rude. And then another one from another band, which had boys and girls in it, was incredibly rude to me. And actually, I got my own back on her because she only wanted a certain brand of water, and we were at a studio in the middle of nowhere, and she kept going on about not wanting this water, and I found a bottle of the brand of water she did want in the bin,
put tap water in it,
but it was also quite at the bottom of the bin. And I was, and then every time she was sipping from it, I was feeling really satisfied. So she was mean. Another woman pop star. I feel like a woman basher, but the women were all the mean ones. Or maybe we just interviewed more.
Also, you do interview more women.
More women. Shut my head in a door. Yeah, because she wanted to wear this outfit, and I said she couldn't wear it because we could see her nipples through it. Mm-hmm. And she shut my head in the door. I had another one. this woman. We were shooting her, and she sort of threw a bit of a tantrum halfway through because she wanted someone to go and buy her some Always Ultra towels. And
for international listeners, they are sanitary towels.
And we were in the middle of nowhere, and we were like, shit, like, you know, obviously you feel bad for someone if they're caught out, but there was a room full of women as well, and we all proffered what sanitary protection we had. And her publicist came out and said, X doesn't do tampons, someone needs to go and get the Always. And we had to send this poor photographer's assistant out, who's like this 17-year-old boy, and he was just like, okay, and he had to go, I think like the nearest Boots was about 5 miles away, and he came back with like armfuls and armfuls of like,
I don't
everything from like these tenor pants that would kind of, you know, absorb an ocean, to these tiny weeny like baby tampons. And I just thought, oh, God, no. Yeah, but, and she literally went through, like, going, well, that hasn't got wings, that hasn't got that. who knew you could be so specific about, you know, if you're caught short, you're caught short.
I thought you were going to say you fashioned something out of some A4 paper and a bit of loo roll.
Yeah, I should have done that. Yeah, that was a good idea.
Bit of sellotape.
Yeah.
Hopefully, there will never, yeah, ever be a next time.
They'll shout at me because I don't have the particular Always Ultras, so.
That is, I mean, there's some behaviour, but that's pretty rich.
You know, people have their favourites, I'm sure. So.
But you also used to do, which was, you could do a takedown. You didn't have to be constantly nice about the people. Like, if people were dicks on shoots, he used to do the takedowns,
yeah,
and say they were dicks.
Yeah, like, I remember a good friend of mine, Jen, she did Justin Bieber, and he was just such an arsehole to her that they basically sort of did... I mean, it's quite popular to do it now, and I think it was less common then. Mm. Just a sort of minute by minute, you know, 10:01, he tells me to F off. Like, 10:02, he sends me out to get him some what-sits or whatever, you know. 10:03, he makes the hairdresser cry. That kind of thing. And I think I quite like reading those takedowns.
I must admit, I do. I've had to stop watching certain TV shows because there were. I was talking to another journalist about this on email the other day, about the people who we would see on TV who were lovely and sweet and kind, and everyone loves them, nation sweetheart, but you know that they've got 100% success rate of making people cry on shoots.
It is difficult, isn't it? Because I think it's a bit like that thing we were saying earlier about, you know, saying to someone, I don't moan about your shit tariffs. They could have had a really, really shitty morning. And so I absolutely, like, if someone's a bit cold, a bit frosty, that kind of thing, I used to think, fair enough.
Yeah.
But to be an out-and-out dick, I think, come on, like, and why are you making the makeup artist cry? She's just going to make you look ugly. Like, that is stupid. Oh, I had another woman who, she was in a bad mood, so she wouldn't lift her head up to have her makeup done. She kept... She sat down with her chin in her chest, and the makeup artist had to get on her hands and knees and lean on her lap to do her makeup, like, face down. She wouldn't put her head
that
up.
Is amazing.
Yeah, it was. I was just like, what? This is ridiculous.
I used to find it quite rude when people fell asleep, but actually now, having worked a bit more on shoots, I actually see the makeup artist doesn't care.
Then they might have just flown in, so it's pretty easy as well. They're not gabbing away. But yeah, the face down one, I was a bit like... What the hell?
Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to wrap up now. So I think the thing that I will be drawing attention to is to your fabulous books.
Thank you.
I think it goes without saying that the links are going to be in the show notes. And I think I want a collective social media bullying of Jo on Twitter, the link to which I will put on,
thank you so much,
on the show notes, to get the fiction book written, because I think we all want to see...
Get some positive trolling going on.
Positive trolling in order to get Ms. Bagshot...
Ms. Bagshot out there.
Onto the bookshelf.
The high-class madam she deserves.
And then when the book is out, I think you should come back and we should talk about that too.
Have a reading.
Maybe we should do a reading with the sex scene.
Oh God, I am having a problem with the sex scene though, because there are quite a lot of words which are quite sexy for a male member. The woman's one I'm really struggling with.
Yeah,
it's kind of only the P word, which is a bit porno. Vagina is too gynecological.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what? I think Grace Timothy, Mumface, who has been on this show before and who has a book coming out. I love the... Have you seen the tagline for her book?
Yeah, I think I have, actually.
When she had a baby and lost her shit.
Yeah.
She's put a Facebook thing out saying the exact same thing. Can anyone think of some synonyms for vagina?
It's so difficult. Yeah, I have had to go with the P. The P word.
Okay. And have you read lots of erotic literature?
It's often the C word.
Oh no.
I think that's too much.
No.
Yeah, we're not.
Are you talking, I know what you're saying, but also my brain just gave me an update, just a ping. Do I also remember that in 50 Shades they also used the word cleft?
Oh, moist cleft. Yeah, they do. Moist cleft. That sounds like something in your bathroom that you were talking about earlier. Oh yeah, I've got a bit of a problem with a moist cleft. I've got to get my damp course done.
Yeah, my air filtration system's broken and my cleft is moist as anything.
Cleft! And also, yeah. Cleft doesn't go anywhere. Cleft is like a little dart in a rock. Like, I mean, I'm sorry, but if you've got a cleft going on, you need to go to the doctor.
Right.
On that note.
I think that's a call to action. Listeners, if you have any preferred words to describe...
That are still sexy.
If you can be anonymous. You can DM me.
Yeah, please do.
Email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM me on Instagram where I'm at Emma Guns, or on Twitter where I'm also at Emma Guns, or DM Jo and I'll
please,
put all her in.
Yeah,
info.
Please tell me. What can I say so I don't have to say pussy all the time?
Yeah, we need to help you with that.
Yeah,
okay,
you need to
excellent.
Help me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming all the way over to my flat. And I can't wait to read your book.
Thank you. I will be sure to send you one.
Before you go, just thought I'd let you know that if you want to get in touch with the show, it couldn't be easier. Just email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. Or you can DM me on Instagram and Twitter, where I am at Emma Guns. And if you've been enjoying the show, whether it was this one or another episode, then please do head over to iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and review to help get the show noticed and set it soaring up the charts. I would be most, most grateful. Thank you again. I have more guests lined up for another episode of The Emma Guns Show, so I look forward to you joining me then.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.